My name is Andreas, and I am 55 years old. A few months ago, I separated from Yamina, who was my girlfriend for almost 7 years. We ended on good terms, or so it seemed. It was one of those breakups where you just realize that things don't work anymore. We talked it over, she left, and I stayed in this apartment alone. I've always been a quiet person. Working as a web developer keeps me busy, but when I get home, I like to disconnect. My only social interaction outside of work is the two stray dogs that are always hanging out near the square. I've fed them several times, and although they are unowned, they seem to be like neighborhood dogs. No one bothers them, and I always see them when I walk by the plaza on my way home from work. Sometimes they come up and I greet them, give them some food, and they go on their way. It all started after the separation. First, it was a couple of times that I noticed some people watching me on my way home from work. I didn't think they were going to get me in trouble. Maybe it was my paranoia or just a coincidence, but as the days went by, the same faces kept appearing, always looking at me, always in the same corner, as if they were waiting for something. They didn't say anything. They just looked at me. I could never quite see their faces, at least one of the two of them. I let it go, but then I started getting strange messages on my social networks. Someone was telling me that they knew where I lived, that they had my schedule under control, that I wasn't going to be alone for long. I thought they were just practical jokes, but those jokes didn't stop. I told myself that these people were not related to those who were watching me, but the coincidence was too much. One afternoon, I came home from work as usual, walking through the square with my headphones on, trying to ignore the stares that I was now sure were not coincidences. In the distance, I saw two guys on a motorcycle, one taller than the other, with a straight face and a strange attitude. It was not only their presence that unsettled me, but the way they were watching me. It was no longer a coincidence. They knew exactly who I was. I quickened my pace with the feeling that they did too. However, the biker never got any closer. They kept their distance as if waiting for the right moment. That was the straw that broke the camel's back. I went to the police station the next day, took the messages, and told everything that was happening to me. But the response was disappointing. They told me that as long as there was no direct threat, they couldn't do anything. In other words, as long as those guys didn't do anything, I was on my own. From that day on, I saw them more often. The men on the motorcycle are always at a distance, but present. Every time I left the house, I felt watched and harassed, without having any idea why. The day it all happened was a national holiday, and as a freelance developer, many times I could stay at home, but other times I had to go out no matter what date it was. That day there was no one on the street. The neighborhood looked like a desert, something quite rare where I lived. I thought that with fewer people around, those guys on the motorcycle wouldn't show up. I was wrong. As I crossed the square, I heard them before I saw them, and before I could react, they were on top of me. This time, they didn't stay at a distance. The taller one got off the bike and hit me in the face without warning. I fell to the ground, dazed, feeling the metallic taste of blood in my mouth. Confused and in pain, I could hear the sadistic laughter of my attacker. He had not attacked me simply to rob me. I recognized that sadistic and unnecessarily cruel laugh. That was my ex's brother. In all the time I had been with her, I had only seen him 2 or 3 times. They had a very bad relationship. Clearly, the man was not attacking me because she had told him. No, he had different motives. The man always hated me from the first time he saw me. Just because I had some money, he always thought I underestimated him and that I was a rich kid. That the moment I stopped being his sister's boyfriend, he would give me a lesson in humility. The other guy, shorter, was still on the bike watching, laughing. I knew that if I didn't do something fast, this wasn't going to end well for me. They were waiting for more than just hitting me. I felt the weight of despair take hold of me. I always knew you were trash. It was obvious that my sister would realize it too. Do you know how much I wanted to do this? Do you know how many fights I had with my family over this? By now, you're not off limits anymore, are you? I tried to speak, but the pain in my body prevented me from doing so. The guy wouldn't stop hitting me. My mind was racing. What had I done to him? Had I looked at him wrong? Had I worn clothes he didn't like? I'm not just here to kill you. I also want your money and your house. But first, it will be your life. He said this with a macabre smile, taking something out of his pocket. It glittered. A gun. Pure fear came over me at that moment. I wasn't going to get out of this alive if I didn't do something. The bike moved a little, as if they were getting ready to leave after they were done with me. I knew this was the moment. I had to act. I had to do something, anything, to get out of this situation. I reached for something with my hand, anything that could serve as a defense. At that moment, I managed to grab a handful of dirt and dust from the floor of the square. Without thinking twice, I threw it straight in his face. His scream of surprise and pain gave me the moment of distraction I needed. I got up as best I could and started running, ignoring the pain in every part of my body. The two guys didn't take long to react. The man jumped on the bike, and the driver accelerated behind me. But I was already halfway to my building. Every step was torture, but the fear was stronger than the pain. I knew that if I got home, maybe I could lock myself in. Maybe I could call for help. But they weren't going to let me get away that easy. I turned a corner, and just before I got to my block, I felt the engine approaching again. The guy had gotten off the bike and was now running toward me with a gun in hand. I had no time to think. As I was about to be cornered, something unexpected happened. The two stray dogs, the same ones I always fed, appeared out of nowhere and pounced on the guy with the gun. Barking filled the air as the dogs attacked him mercilessly. The guy screamed and tried to defend himself, but the dogs wouldn't let him. The other one, the one driving the motorcycle, tried to approach to help him, but stopped when he saw the scene. It was clear that he was not expecting it. The man threatened to attack one of the dogs, but he seemed panicked. He was terrified of dogs. Furious, the man ran to the motorcycle, and the other man sped off. Days after the attack, the police informed me that the two men were in custody and would face serious charges. Yamina didn't know anything about them, but she always knew that her brother hated me. She just didn't want to tell me as so not to scare me. The motives? You could say none. He was always an obsessive and violent man. A thief, and although he never admitted it, a murderer. The dogs, my saviors, I saw them the next day. They were in the neighborhood as usual, quiet. I approached them and fed them as I used to do. That day it was quite cold and I decided to take them to my house. One thing led to another, and I ended up adopting them.
When I decided to move into this apartment, I didn't do it on a whim. My life had taken a sharp turn after my separation. She was never a fan of my pets, but to me, the dog and the two cats were my family. She said that they made a lot of noise, that they filled everything with hair, and that the house smelled bad because of them. It was clear that for her, my animals were always a nuisance. The place I moved into was a small, old, and quite secluded apartment. I didn't mind. What I needed was a space to be alone, away from everything that reminded me of my former life. I took a few things with me, the most basic things, some furniture, my computer, clothes, and, of course, Roy, my dog, and the cats, Sam and Oscar. The only thing that interested me at that moment was to make my animals comfortable and adapt to this new beginning. From day one, Roy and the cats seemed uncomfortable. Roy, a quiet German shepherd, was restless, always moving around, something he never did before. The cats, on the other hand, were even worse. Sam kept hiding, while Oscar's fur was bristling almost all the time. But I thought it was normal. You know, a change of environment always affected them a little. I never imagined that the worst was yet to come. Days went by and things didn't get any better. Roy would bark at odd times as if he was hearing something that I couldn't. Sam and Oscar were still nervous, breaking things or hiding in the strangest places. Every day I came home from work, I would find something broken. Glasses, plates, and once even a painting. I attributed it all to the stress of the move, to his need to adjust to the new home. Although something was bothering me, I didn't think much of it. I still thought it was just something temporary. But one day, everything got worse. That day, I came home exhausted, working, taking care of the animals, and adapting to the new routine had already pushed me to the limit. However, what I found when I opened the door was more than frustrating. Broken dishes all over the floor, but worst of all, an overturned chair in the middle of the living room. Cats didn't have the strength to do that, and Roy, being as calm as he was, had never done anything like that before. Something just didn't add up. I felt a mixture of anger and bewilderment. I approached Roy, who was looking at me from the corner of the room, calm, as if nothing had happened. The cats were hiding again, as usual. My frustration grew with each passing minute. What the hell was wrong with them? I decided to set up a camera to record what was happening while I was gone. I wanted to understand what was causing the chaos. I thought maybe it was some strange behavior from Roy, or that the cats were crazier than I thought. The thought of something else never crossed my mind. That night, however, things didn't get any better. On the contrary, I felt the animals were more tense than ever. Roy kept staring at the walls, while Sam and Oscar avoided coming out of their hiding places. I set up a camera, and then I tried to relax and forget about the situation, hoping that the next day the recording would give me some answers. The next morning, as soon as I woke up, I went straight to review the recording. I sat in front of the computer, hoping to see something that would explain what was going on. What I saw left me paralyzed. In the recording, Roy was lying down, as usual, calm. Sam and Oscar were wandering around the room, nervous but not making much noise. Everything seemed normal until, suddenly, something changed. The cats began to behave strangely, as if they were watching something that wasn't on camera. They backed away, their fur completely ruffled, and suddenly both of them shot off in different directions as if something invisible had attacked them. Roy, on the other hand, just watched, confused. He didn't move, just looked at what was happening without understanding. But there was nothing there. Nothing visible, at least. I leaned closer to the monitor, trying to catch some details that I might have missed. Then I saw it. The chair I had found overturned the night before suddenly lifted and threw itself to the floor with a force that neither my cats nor my dog could have generated. My stomach knotted. I stopped the video and looked up. Roy was looking at me from the doorway of the room, but not at me, beyond me, toward a spot on the wall. When I turned around, Sam and Oscar were looking at the same spot. The cats followed something with their eyes that I couldn't see, as if that something was moving around the room. Their heads were turning in sync, following the movement of the invisible thing. Roy stood up and started barking, but not at the wall, directly beside me. The sound of the barking snapped me out of my stupor, and I turned to look, my heart racing just as something threw me violently against the wall. I felt the impact all over my body. But before I could react, I was dragged across the floor, slamming into the furniture as if an invisible force was controlling me. It was as if someone was holding my ankles and dragging me from one side of the room to the other. My arms were hitting the corners of the tables, chairs, and my head was rubbing the floor hard. I tried to hold on to whatever I could, the couch, a table, but the force pulling me was relentless. There seemed to be no escape. Everything was just spinning around me. The air felt heavy, and I couldn't see my assailant, but I knew something was there. Just when I thought it couldn't get any worse, I felt a pressure in my chest. Something invisible was crushing me, choking me. My lungs burned as I struggled to breathe. I was on the verge of losing consciousness when suddenly, everything stopped. In pain and scared, I crawled as best I could to where the cats were. I grabbed a cage I had to carry them in and got Sam and Oscar in as quickly as I could. Roy kept barking and moving from one side of the room to the other, as if he also felt the presence of that thing, whatever it was that had attacked me. I put a leash on him with trembling hands as I tried to stay calm. Everything in the house was silent, but I felt that something else was with me. Time seemed to have stopped. I headed for the exit door with the cat cage in one hand and Roy pulling the leash in the other. Sweat beaded on my forehead as my footsteps echoed on the hardwood floor. When I reached the lobby of the building, I saw a figure. An older woman standing right in front of me. She looked charred as if she had been burned to ashes. Her skin still smoldered and nothing but darkness came out of her empty sockets. She held a cane in a trembling hand and her jaw hung open in an unnatural gesture. It was looking at me, or so it seemed, for it had no eyes. Terror left me motionless for a second. But when it started moving towards me, I broke into a run. I ran as fast as I could out of the building without looking back, my heart pounding in my ears. When I reached the street, I stopped only long enough to make sure my pets were okay. I couldn't believe what had just happened. What was that thing? What had made my animals so scared? A few days later, while I was looking for a new place to move, I went back to the apartment to pick up the rest of my things. A neighbor approached me, an older man who had lived in the building for years. He told me a chilling story. The woman who had lived in my apartment before me had died of an electrocution in her bathroom. No one in the building loved her, and that included her children, who never visited her. And according to the neighbor, they were right not to. You know what else he told me? He told me that she had problems with the other neighbors for something in particular. This lady was known for mistreating the neighbors' animals whenever she could. She hated them. But if there were any animals she hated more than the rest, it was the cats.
It had been a week since my Laura went missing. The cops were looking everywhere for my daughter, and I was at home praying to dear Jesus to get my kid back to me. Her little boy, my grandson, was with me too, and it was heartbreaking to see him stare at the door, waiting for his mom to walk through it. That's when the phone rang in the afternoon. My husband, Jacob, was out there, trying his best to find his baby girl. I picked up the call.
I've got her.
A deep male voice said from the other end and hung up. For a few seconds, I was just standing there with the receiver in my hand, making sense of what had just happened. Her kidnapper had called. I did the sensible thing and called the cops and my husband, informing them about the call. Since that week, every Wednesday afternoon, mostly when I was all alone in the house, or with my grandson, the phone rang, and the same man either told me that he had Laura, or he had already killed her. But why would anyone want to harm my sweet daughter? As a mother, the most important thing for you is the safety and happiness of your child. So when your kid is in danger, or goes missing, it's the most terrifying and heartbreaking thing in the world. It all started in January 1980. My grandson Abel had just turned 4, and Laura, my daughter, was working as a secretary at 2 jointly owned stores. She was a Catholic, God-fearing single mother. Her son was her entire world, and she loved him a lot. Whenever she was working, I and my husband used to look after him. One day, while she was working, she received a phone call.
I hope I've reached Laura Scott.
Yes, this is her. Who are you, sir?
I'm your lover, darling.
When Laura heard those words, her first reaction was disbelief. She thought someone was pranking her. I'm sorry, but I do not have a lover, and this is an office, so please do not prank call here again. Saying that, she hung up. Days passed, and she again got a phone call in her office.
Is this Laura Scott?
Yes, this is her. How may I help you, sir?
You hung up the phone last time, bitch. I told you I loved you, and you hung up the phone. You insulted me, and now I'm going to kill you. Watch out, my love. I'm going to end you.
With that, the line went silent. Laura sat there in her office, shocked and unable to process what had just happened. As it was just the second call, she ignored it. But soon the frequency of these calls increased, and the mysterious man who always refused to reveal his identity and always addressed himself as Laura's lover. I and my husband Jacob knew that Laura had no steady boyfriend, as she was mostly occupied with her job and then looking after her son. She did go on a few dates, but nothing more than that would ever happen. One evening when the four of us were in my house about to start dinner, the phone rang, and Laura picked it up.
Hello, darling.
The expression on Laura's face told us immediately who the caller was. Before she could get a word out, the man said something.
Would you mind going out and checking your car? I have a surprise for you, sweetheart.
Laura hung up the phone, and she ran to her car, followed by Jacob. There they found a dead rose on the windshield. After that incident, we called the cops and told them everything about the phone calls and the dead rose. Although they agreed to cooperate, they couldn't do much at that stage, as no one knew who the caller was. But the phone calls didn't stop. He threatened Laura for calling the cops. He also declared his undying love and lust for her. When this became overwhelming, Jacob suggested she bear a firearm with her, a small gun. Laura also enrolled in karate classes for her own safety. Exactly a week after that, Laura and one of her colleagues took a third colleague to an emergency room as he had a spider bite. When Laura went to get out of the car to the front of the hospital so the three of them could go back to the office, instead of stopping by the hospital's main door, the car drove off. Due to the bright flashlights, none of her colleagues could see who was driving the car. That was on May 28, 1980, the day my daughter got abducted. Hours after this incident, she was reported missing. And a week later, I started getting those terrifying calls from the perpetrator himself. So the news spread like wildfire, and on June 12, 1980, the day when Laura's case was covered by the local newspaper called the Orange County Register, an unidentified man called the front desk and confessed to killing my daughter.
I killed her. I killed Laura Scott. She was my love. I caught her cheating with another man. She denied having someone else. So I killed her and chopped her body into small pieces so that no one will ever find her.
The man said before hanging up. The investigation continued, but neither Laura was found nor her killer were arrested on that day or the days following it. The call to the editor of the newspaper was the last time the murderer ever contacted anyone. After that, the calls to our house stopped and the case ran cold. 4 years had passed and my grandson was 8 now. He was living with us. Jacob got a call from the sheriff's office that they had found something and we were called to the office immediately. They had found some human bones on a construction site a few miles away from the hospital where Laura was last seen. I was devastated, and after they ran a DNA test, it was confirmed that my daughter had perished and probably died a painful death. 30 years later, here I am in a retirement home, waiting for justice to be served for my only daughter. My husband Jacob passed away in the late 1990s, leaving me to look after my grandson. It's heartbreaking to lose a family member, let alone to an unidentified psychopath. All I hope is for her to rest in peace wherever she is. God bless her soul. And if anyone of you watching this story has any information about the killer, please contact me or my grandson. This story was a dramatized version of the real abduction and murder of Dorothy Jane Scott, who lived in Anaheim, California. According to the statements given by the detective investigating her case, it seemed like a case of unrequited love, and even after 50 years, the murderer was never caught, but it seemed like the doing of a psychopath.